just overwhelming. I will try to do a little bit, okay? First we have William Keel. By the way, it's going to go back and forth in some way that I'm certain they've worked out.
Mostly.
Bill Keel, as I mentioned, is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Alabama. He did his bachelor's work in physics and astronomy at Vanderbilt in 1978 and a PhD in astronomy at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He served in countless different positions, including research associate at Kitt Peak National Observatory, a senior research astronomer in the Netherlands, and I think he did a lot of, he did some work in the Soviet Union, if I remember correctly. Let me get this straight. But anyway, he has a testimony that's quite touching as well, and many of this was featured on the wonderful interview that Dave Fisher has prepared for Breakpoint. I don't know if any of you were able to hear the advertisement or the discussion of this meeting that went on Chuck Colson's Breakpoint radio program recently. And in it, some of the testimony from our speakers this weekend were mentioned on the program. Bill Keel was raised in a church going home, but during his junior year of college, he felt a lot of oppressive wrongness, as he described it, in his life. And he found graduate school later on at UC Santa Cruz to be a very sharp testing ground for his faith. And he realized that he needed the faith to persevere in spite of the lack of support that he found in his academic community. He faced a crisis in his life, and through many crises in his life, his walk with Christ has been deepened. And I think that his faith is shown most clearly when you look at his webpage. He's an unashamed Christian, and his webpages show both his studies of the heavens and also his ministry to students. He's taught many students about the relationship of faith and science, and he's helped them to develop a worldview that fits together. He's here with his wife and two sons. They belong to First Wesleyan of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He's active in the music ministry where he plays the trombone in the church. And I asked him what he likes to do for fun, and he said he likes to gaze into the sky for fun. So what better hobby for an astronomer than astronomy? Okay. We are so delighted to have Alan Stockton with us. Alan Stockton, I hear so much about as well because one of his former students works with me or in the same department as I now at Johns Hopkins University. Alan Stockton achieved his bachelor's degree from the University of California at Berkeley in physics and a PhD from the University of Arizona in Tucson in astronomy. He has many awards, the Molman Prize, the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in 1987. He has many appointments. Also, he has worked at Kitt Peak National Observatory, and for many years he's worked at the Institute for Astronomy at the University of Hawaii. He's mentored many students. He has, both of these gentlemen have publication lists that spew off the edge of anyone's computer screen. Very long publication lists. Alan Stockton is here with his wife, Karen. They've been married for 32 years. They have two grown children, Hillary and Jeffrey, and they are both members of the First Presbyterian Church in Honolulu. Karen is a deacon. Alan teaches adult Sunday school classes. And one of his recent thesis students, Gabriella Canalizo, Gabby, are you here? Is right here, okay. So she's participating in the meeting. Alan also is a shining example of someone who shows both professional expertise and Christian faith by working in his church as well as in his research. These gentlemen look at high redshift galaxies. That's what astronomers talk about for galaxies that are far off in the distance, and I hope they'll explain that concept. And they study things that are hard for us to fathom. So hopefully this morning it will help us to fathom these magnificent concepts. We're very excited to hear what you have to teach us about God's marvelous and dynamic universe. And we welcome Bill Keel and Alan Stockton this morning.
Could I have the lights dimmed slightly up here, please? Today, what you can think of what we're doing as simply expanding on part of that nice talk that Debbie Harsma gave last night, the part on galaxies. What we're going to be doing is looking at where these magnificent galaxies, these beautiful forms that we see, how they could have come to be. Again, can we dim the lights? Okay, I'd like it dim for some of the pictures we have later. That helps. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Okay, so what we're going to do first is, in some ways, kind of overlaps with what Debbie did last night. We're going to show you some of the nearby galaxies, and I'm not going to talk a lot about them. I'm just going to move them by, and you should just kind of absorb a sense of the similarities and differences that we see in these. This is, of course, the Andromeda Nebula, that the M31 that Debbie showed last night, roughly 100,000 light years across. And we'll just go through a bunch of similar galaxies here. Significant that we find these forms very beautiful, and these are forms, of course, that humans never saw until this century. I'm going to say a little bit about this one. This is one of our close neighbors, M82. It's a galaxy in a group that's quite close to our own local group that Debbie mentioned last night. In this galaxy, what we now understand to be happening is that, right here in the center, right here in the center, where you can't see clearly all the way down to the center because of all the obscuration that is present there, but apparently there's a huge burst of star formation. Large numbers of stars are forming down in the center. Supernovae are going off, exploding stars. There are winds from the very bright, hot stars. And these winds are driving gas out of the galaxy along the poles of the galaxy. And that's the red filaments that you see there. So this is an awesome, on an awesome scale, we are seeing almost an explosion in the center of this galaxy. Now, as Debbie pointed out last night, galaxies tend to be in groups. They tend to like to be together. They're social. Debbie mentioned stars. The mean separation between stars is very large. You remember the tennis ball? The next nearest tennis ball is 1,100 miles away. Well, you notice that galaxies often are in groups where the separation between the galaxies is not much larger than the galaxies themselves. This means that galaxies occasionally are going to encounter each other. And that's exactly what we see in this next picture. Here we have a pair of galaxies that are colliding. These are a pair of spiral galaxies. This is a magnificent picture from the new ACS instrument on HST. This is actually called the mice, because it looks like a pair of mice kind of talking to each other. Okay, well, how does this thing happen? One of my colleagues at the Institute for Astronomy has done computer simulations of how this might happen. So here you see the two galaxies colliding and this enormous flinging off of material and stars. And finally, the remnants settling together. This is one way we think that we might form elliptical galaxies from pairs of spiral galaxies. Here's the part of that simulation that most closely resembles what we actually see. And I'm going to fade it into the actual pair there. So through these computer simulations, we think we're beginning to understand what happens in these encounters. These encounters on an awesome scale. And this turns out to be something that's fairly important in the development of galaxies in the early universe, we now believe. Now, this title is actually taken from one of Bill's books that he just recently published, The Road to Galaxy Formation. As he mentioned to me yesterday, we can interpret this in two ways: the road by which galaxies have formed, and the road by which we go the other way and try to understand how they formed. And so this is just going to be sort of a summary of what we're going to go through in this talk. First of all, the same thing that Debbie mentioned last night, the cosmic time machine, how we can actually see into the past. We'll explain a bit about how we know the universe is expanding. We're going to mention some of the new techniques that have just been developed in the last 10 years or so that allow us to explore in great detail what galaxies look like in the early universe. And one of the consequences of this is that we see that the galaxies in the universe look differently from the galaxies that we see around us today. There has been a change. The universe is a dynamic place. Bill is going to go into what we think happened with the very first stars, which were formed only of hydrogen and helium, and then the formation of galaxies themselves. We'll talk a little bit about how the bigger picture, how this all interacts. How stars make the chemical elements that are in the Earth and in our bodies, how galaxies are important in this total picture, and the requirements for life. And this leads us into what's called the anthropic principle. We're just going to say a few words about that. There are people here in the audience that are much better experts at this than either of us, I believe. And then finally, the question of really how do the heavens declare the glory of God? How are we to interpret this statement? First, I just want to say a little bit about cosmology as a science. Now, science normally depends on comparing many examples of a single class or the ability to run the same experiment many times under controlled conditions. I'll take an example from biology, which I don't know anything about. But if you suppose you had a hypothesis that all mammals bore their young live, and you looked at cows and kangaroos and possums and porcupines, and you found this to be true until you ran across a duck-billed platypus. And there you find a creature that lays an egg but still suckles its young. Okay, you have many, many species of animals that you can deal with here to test your hypothesis. Problem is, we have only one universe that's accessible to our study. So this makes cosmology somewhat ambiguous as a science. We can't really distinguish easily what are the essential properties of the universe and what we might call the accidental properties of the universe. If we were to rerun the universe many times, how similar would it look to the universe we have today? We do have one enormous advantage over the other historical sciences, and that's that we can actually see the past. If you're dealing with evolutionary biology or geology, you have to take what's survived up into the present in order to study the essence of your field. We have the advantage that we can actually look back into time. So we have what Debbie and we have called the cosmic time machine. And this is simply the fact that the finite speed of light means that we always see things after they've happened. The light that we see from the sun left it 8 minutes ago. The light from the most distant galaxies we can see left those galaxies about 12 billion years ago. So another way of putting this is astronomical telescopes are one-way time machines. We can't avoid, if we're looking out at a distance, we can't avoid observing the past. Or another way of putting it is that distances and time are always mixed in astronomical observations. There's a relation between distance and time in the past. Now, the expansion of the universe is something that I think probably everyone in this room is aware of. We see features in the spectra of galaxies, and we'll go into more detail later on that. Virtually always appear at longer wavelengths than we observe those same chemical transitions here on Earth. And that's interpreted as the essentially the fabric of space is expanding. The first observational evidence for this, there was actually some observations before Hubble, but Hubble was the one that really pointed this out, found this distance redshift relation. We call this the fact that the spectral lines appear at longer wavelengths, the redshift, because features are shifted toward the red end of the spectrum. Now, this was actually predicted. It's a consequence of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Einstein, as Debbie mentioned last night, actually somewhat punted on that one because he believed in a static universe, but Friedman had pointed out that it was a natural consequence of Einstein's equations. Now, distance in an expanding universe is not a very simple concept. If you pick different ways of measuring distance, you come up with different answers. So we don't normally, except in special cases, talk about kinds of distance in astronomy. Instead, we use the term look-back time, at least for our conversation today, our presentation today. This is a more useful thing to talk about, and that's simply the time the light takes to get to us from an object. How long is that? But we can't observe look-back time directly. What we observe is this redshift, which astronomers use the term Z for. That's what we actually observe. In order to get look-back time, you have to know both what the relationship between redshift and essentially getting a distance scale, and we need to know the cosmological model. How has that distance scale changed with time? So those are the two things we need to know in order to go from what we observe to an actual look-back time. Oops, I think I'm going into your part here.
Okay. Since the redshift measurement is such a big part of what we're talking about in cosmic history, we want to go back and point out how we do this. This is the spectrum of the sun wrapped around so it will fit here. These are individual slices of spectrum that if you put them all together would give you the whole rainbow all the way around the hall. And you can see many dark missing wavelengths here. These are absorption lines from various kinds of atoms, ionic species, in the sun's atmosphere. Some prominent ones are the red line of hydrogen H-alpha, the twin sodium lines in the yellow-orange, familiar to way too many people as the baleful glow of streetlights. A lot of the transitions in here come from iron, set here from magnesium. We can identify these transitions with various strengths in stars and the mixes of stars that we see with galaxies. And understanding these patterns lets us tell whether we see them with various shifts. It's an example of the spectra of a couple of galaxies with rather similar mixes of stars to avoid an extra complication. And here plotted as energy received per unit wavelength versus wavelength, essentially throughout the visible window. This is a nearby elliptical galaxy where we see everything very close to the lab wavelength. And if I could go back and forth without being too confusing, you'd see out here, this is this pair of sodium lines, H-alpha absorption, very prominent pair of calcium lines that you see in cool stars from elliptical galaxies. And up here is a galaxy at a redshift of 0.25. No, I'll explain in a second what the Z means. We see the same features now shifted to the red and stretched. The wavelength each piece of the spectrum started with has been multiplied by this stretching factor. So the two calcium lines are here. There's a molecular absorption band that goes from here. You can watch this so-called G band ends up here. This magnesium feature ends up out here. So we can see for a couple of concrete examples what the redshift stretch has done. And this quantity Z is dimensionless. It's defined as, for any individual transition, the shift in wavelength divided by the initial or laboratory wavelength. And this is what we can observe. This is a measurement you can make in various ways from measured spectra. And it turns out this redshift tells you the factor by which the universe has expanded while this light was in transit. And what we'd like to do is go from this expansion factor to an amount of time, which means that we have to know the rate of cosmic expansion and how that rate has changed with time. This diagram shows how we're looking back through time for the cosmological parameters that resulted from the consensus around the WMAP mission that Debbie mentioned last night. Oops. Let me back up. So across the bottom, we've plotted redshift, Z. The limit of secure observations at this point is at about 6.4 in redshift for quasars, something like 6.8 for galaxies. And we have look-back time in billions of years. So this curve tells us what the look-back time is for something observed at a particular redshift. One reason we expect galaxies to start looking different is that we see different mixes of stars. If we imagine a set of original equipment stars in a galaxy that formed, say, 13 billion years ago, none of its stars at the sun's mass or above survive today from that initial epoch. But if we look at galaxies at a redshift of about a half, we'll see the one solar mass stars. These bars represent how long stars of different masses from the formation of the galaxy would survive. If we look at about redshift 4, we see all of the original two solar mass stars. So this means that a galaxy that made all its stars very quickly would have been much more luminous and much bluer when we see it back here. And we find from a variety of measurements, variety of properties of galaxies, that they do change with redshift. Powerful evidence that the universe is evolving. Changes in the mix of stars making up galaxies of a particular kind, their gas content, chemical composition, and the dynamical structure. For a variety of reasons, we expect to see these changes most obviously at high redshift. Things were changing very fast. A unit change in redshift corresponds to shorter and shorter times as we go on to more distant universe. And we expect to see them most at short wavelengths, say in the ultraviolet, where short-lived stars are bright. This is very convenient because this is what cosmic expansion brings into the window for analysis with ground-based telescopes. There's a variety of new techniques, particularly in the last decade, which have allowed us to probe in an unprecedented degree the early history of galaxies. The most familiar, perhaps, are powerful telescopes in space. Above all, Hubble. It's X-ray complements, more recently deployed, Chandra and the European exonym Newton. Satellites to map the cosmic microwave background, such as WMAP. The forthcoming infrared great observatory, which I think is still scheduled to launch about a month from now, CERTIF, which is going to have a different name, but that name is not being revealed until it's actually working. At the same time, there's been a new generation of unprecedentedly large optical and infrared telescopes on the ground. Though I guess Mauna Kea just barely qualifies as on the ground. With 8 to 10 meter apertures, these are what you need to measure the spectra of the faint objects that deep fields with Hubble can detect. And what people barely dared hope when these telescopes were originally envisaged is that there are techniques now coming to fruition that enable us to substantially cancel the distorting effects of the Earth's atmosphere. Okay, so this, I realize that Hubble is now an icon of not just astronomy, but the culture. When I was at the Museum of Science and Nature yesterday, you could buy a little Hubble. There's now a Lego set of a space shuttle deploying Hubble. So this is how you know it's penetrated the culture. The Hubble Space Telescope contains a 2.4 meter primary mirror, which after optical correction approaches very closely to theoretically perfect optical performance. Delivers a very sharp and very stable image. It works from fairly far into the ultraviolet into the near infrared. The planned lifetime is 20 years, and there's some discussion now on what to do now with the telescope in 2010. And its instrumentation has been kept close to the technological forefront by successive servicing missions, the most recent of which was the final complete mission of Columbia. Hubble was planned by the NASA Astrophysics Program as one of four so-called great observatories, which included the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory and two others, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, seen here, which is in a very high, it's about a four-day orbit of Earth, with exquisite resolution, half-arc-second resolution. The X-ray images from Chandra are sharper than almost all ordinary ground-based images. It's very high resolution for imaging and spectra. It's proven to be an unparalleled probe of active galaxies, quasars and their kin, and thus the growth of massive black holes through cosmic time. At almost the same time, the European Space Agency launched a counterpart with a somewhat different mix of properties known as exonym Newton, and these have in fact been used together in a number of studies. This picture actually shows a large fraction of all 8 and 10 meter telescopes at the summit of Mauna Kea. It's one of the two 10 meter segmented mirror Keck telescopes, the Subaru telescope of the Japanese National Observatory. There are also four 8 meter telescopes operated by the European Southern Observatory in Chile. Behind the viewpoint here is one of the two 8 meter Gemini telescopes, which are an international collaboration that we did not have time to put the partners on the slide of. And Alan has done a lot more, which would be by definition, because I've done none, with adaptive optics. So I'll let him move in and talk a little bit about these techniques that enable us to do things with ground-based telescopes that we wouldn't have dreamed of 10 years ago.
Yeah. Adaptive optics is something that has just come into the forefront in the last 5 or 6 years. It allows us to use ground-based telescopes to approach and even exceed the resolution we get from the Hubble Space Telescope. Basically, you can think of it as using a bright star as a reference and using that light from that star as it comes through the atmosphere to tell you what the atmosphere is doing to distort light from that part of the sky. As the if you're familiar with looking across a hot parking lot on a warm day and you see the shimmering of things on the other side of the parking lot, we astronomers deal with that all the time from light coming through the atmosphere. So basically what we've learned to do here, at least in the near infrared, around between 1 and 2 microns, is to compute what's happening to the light as it comes to the atmosphere, determine how we need to correct that light. We send the correction signals to a mirror that we can control the shape of. And so we essentially put in the opposite distortion and essentially take out the effect of the atmosphere. And at sort of in the middle of the near-infrared, we can achieve close to the fractional limit of an 8 to 10 meter telescope, which is roughly 10 times better than we can get from the average natural seeing. And in some cases, 3 or 4 times better than the HST, the Hubble Space Telescope, can do at the same wavelength. So here's an example. This is an image taken with the Gemini telescope under actually exquisite conditions, much better than we normally achieve. And here is the same field after adaptive optics has corrected it. This gives some of the particulars. And here's an example of adaptive optics. This is actually done in the laboratory. But it very closely mimics what we would actually see if you magnify the image of a star through the telescope a lot. You can see the star dancing around there, this image of the star. You can see little speckles of patterns. In a moment, they turn on, I guess right now, they've turned on something that will centroid the star. It keeps it from dancing around, but you still see that the light is spread out into these speckles. And now we turn on the adaptive optics, and all the light gloms into the center. Oops, it's rather washed out there. Anyway, that gives you an idea of what it does. And it actually works as long as you have a bright star nearby. We'll go on to another technique.
Yeah. Astronomers have also been learning to make better and better use of these large telescopes. In particular, we've benefited from the electronics revolution in being able to detect light no longer with chemical processes in photographic emulsions, but with solid-state detectors, which closely approach 100% efficiency, as well as high degrees of linearity and repeatability. As they get larger and larger, we can survey more of the sky, not only in images, but for measuring spectra. One technique which has become very common is multi-object spectroscopy. And here's an example of the data chain, starting with instruments on, in this case, the 8-meter Gemini North telescope. So we would start by getting a short exposure of the piece of the sky that we want to observe to make sure that we have all the distortions right. Then we get the coordinate mapping done and use a software tool to tell you if we put the following set of short slits on our objects, this is the spectral coverage we can get without them overlapping. So the idea here is that each of these long streaks represents the area on the detector that will be covered by the spectrum of the object in the middle. And it's possible to lay out now with some spectrographs to get several hundred objects in one piece of the sky. And if each one of these objects would require 4 hours of time on one of the world's largest telescopes, you can see that being able to do 100 at once is a great advance. So here is the data. Each one of these patterns now represents what comes through the spectrograph slit, dispersed in wavelength from blue to red. All these vertical streaks are air glow from the Earth's atmosphere. Mostly they're hydroxyl emission lines. And in a few cases here, you can see the horizontal streak marking the faint object. When you subtract the sky, you get a fairly clean spectrum. In this case, we see a galaxy redshift 3.5. This is an emission line that started off deep in the ultraviolet. Submillimeter astronomy has taken huge leaps. This was a technologically very difficult area because of the need for very precise antennas, such as this 10-meter dish at Mauna Kea. Cryogenic detector arrays of exquisite sensitivity. I've heard the SCUBA array next door to this dome described as the largest piece of material that cold that anyone knows of, liquid helium temperatures. And the extension of interferometry to arrays of submillimeter telescopes. These instruments are sensitive to the emission from warm dust in galaxies at high redshift. This is important because, as we saw in some of Debbie's pictures last night, stars are born in areas rich in gas and dust. This is an example of one of the basic laws of nature, that the action always seems to take place in locations that are very hard to see. So here, we don't have to worry about dust blocking our view because the dust is our view. So surveys with these instruments and their longer wavelength space counterparts can show us where actively star-forming galaxies were in the early universe, even if all of their optical light has been soaked up by the dust. Okay, just reiterate now, these techniques are all letting us approach the time when galaxies took their shape. We can approach this in two ways. We can first take advantage of this leverage that cosmology has, that looking out can't help looking back. And we can also take a quite thoroughly petrified leaf from the pages of some of our colleagues in other disciplines and look at the fossil record. Many of the properties of stars are essentially frozen when they are formed. The chemistry of a star's surface, what shows up when you measure its spectrum, stays essentially unchanged by internal reactions in the star until quite late in its history. So we can do accurate surveys of the chemical makeup of stars in our galaxy. The orbits of stars, likewise, change very slowly once they're formed. Unlike big fluffy clouds of gas, stars penetrate gas clouds and respond only to gravity once they're formed. So the chemical makeup and motions of stars in our galaxy and nearby galaxies preserve a historical record. And the first realization of this goes back now 40 years. And we still have this picture that the oldest, most chemically pristine stars in our galaxy preserve a nearly round and almost non-rotating shape, whereas the more recently formed stars have been enriched by the products of previous generations of stars for a progressively flatter disk until today, where stars are formed in the Milky Way, where the thick gas is all in thin disk containing the spiral arms. So this is a very quick rundown of what we see in galaxies today. You know, I will now compress into this what I normally spend an entire semester with graduate students doing. Galaxies have long been seen to be divided into several basic morphological types, the elliptical ones, the spirals that make such pretty pictures for the textbooks, and the irregulars, which are in many ways a continuation of the spirals. Came up with a classification based on this in the 1920s. It's still in use because it has the remarkable property that you can look at the appearance of a galaxy on a photograph and immediately you know a lot about its history. Elliptical galaxies, by and large, formed all their stars in a very brief time, early in cosmic history, and none since then. Spiral galaxies formed some early on, generally in this central bulge. And since then, star formation has been going on in this gas-rich disk. It's the location of star formation that traces out the spiral arms. Irregular galaxies have sort of been puttering along, making stars at about the same rate over cosmic history. Generally, they're small enough that their dynamics can't organize these very pleasing spiral patterns. As in many kinds of objects, we find that the bigger and brighter it is, the rarer it is. So the most common kind of galaxy in the universe is a dwarf galaxy, which may be extremely hard to see once we get beyond our own neighborhood. For most galaxies, we find that dark matter dominates the overall dynamics. In typical big spirals like the Milky Way, dark matter comprises something like 9/10 of the total betrayed by gravity. And as we said before, in spirals like our own, the central round bulge and the flat disk differ in their histories, stellar content, and chemistry. With the advent particularly of images in deep fields done by Hubble, we can compare galaxies today with galaxies in the early universe. It has to be done with some care because what we see in galaxies today, what's easiest to see, is in visible light. These are all the familiar pictures of galaxies. And what we can get the highest resolution on at high redshift is what started off in the ultraviolet. So we have to be careful to look at the nearby galaxies that way. But as we look into the early universe at high redshifts, look back times of 6 to 10 billion years, virtually everybody who's looked at these deep Hubble data has remarked that galaxies used to look weird. The pretty symmetric spirals become rarer and rarer. What you see are very asymmetric, blobby, in the dynamical jargon, unrelaxed looking systems, as if these galaxies have yet to settle down into their nice rotationally symmetric forms. And it's tempting to associate this with the results of cosmological models, which suggest that the first lumps to come together should be smaller than today's galaxies, sometimes called subgalactic clumps. And we can trace the evolution of galaxies with redshift, with cosmic time, in several ways. The mix of galaxy types in clusters of galaxies changes. Today, rich clusters of galaxies contain only elliptical and other non-star-forming galaxies. Several billion years ago, they were rich in spirals. 6 or 8 billion years ago, they were almost purely spirals. We can look at the populations of stars by looking at what they contribute to a galaxy's spectrum. We can look at the sizes and luminosity of galaxies, as well as the structure, the morphological types that we just showed. We can measure the star formation rate in different ways. There are ultraviolet emission, far infrared. And it turns out that finally we're starting to see the connection between nuclear activity, the occurrence of quasars, and the growth and history of galaxies. There's now a whole bestiary of ways we can find galaxies in the early universe, because it's not that they're necessarily so faint that we can't see them. It's that they're hiding out among huge numbers of closer, dimmer galaxies that are not of interest for what we're talking about right now. A very powerful technique uses the fact that hydrogen gas absorbs radiation below its ionization frequency very effectively at the so-called Lyman break. We can find galaxies from submillimeter emission, which are at high redshift. Certain kinds of extremely red faint objects turn out to be galaxies in the early universe. They're red either because they're dusty, active star formation is associated with this dust, or because they are the oldest galaxies in the universe, and their stellar populations are the oldest for the redshift where we see them. And from their ultraviolet emission, in particular emission from their hydrogen gas, we can pick up what we think are very primitive objects that are so small that we're tempted to call them subgalactic. Finally, we can find quasars and radio galaxies. These are the easiest of the whole bunch to find. And sometimes we can find and categorize galaxies that we can't see, because some of their gas happens to block the light from a background quasar. So in fact, a lot of the statistical knowledge about galaxy history is based on seeing their absorption features show up in the background lighthouse of a powerful object, rather than on seeing the galaxy itself. These are often found in combinations. As we see, galaxies are very social, so they were also gregarious in the early universe. As I mentioned, in so-called Lyman-Brake selection technique uses the fact that the light coming from a distant galaxy will be truncated at the ionization point of hydrogen, below 912 angstroms, energy above 13.6 electron volts. And this means that if you look at a piece of the sky very deeply with multiple filters spread through the spectrum, very high redshift galaxies will show up as fairly bright and even bluish in the long wavelength filters and will vanish when your filter goes to a shorter wavelength than the 912 angstroms times 1 plus the galaxy's redshift. And several groups, particularly a group at Caltech, have found thousands of galaxies at high redshift through this technique. They have refined it to the point where they can read them in as fast as they can get to the telescope. To show the technique, this is the ultraviolet spectrum from satellite data of a star-forming region in a nearby galaxy, M33, the pinwheel. So this is now very short wavelength, showing from 912 to 1600 angstroms, 91 to 160 nanometers. You see the spectrum continues fairly flat until suddenly it truncates due to hydrogen absorption. If there's not enough hydrogen in the galaxy, there will be enough in the intervening space to cut it off this way. Here's how it applies to more distant galaxies. This is the brightest Lyman-Brake galaxy in the famous Hubble Deep Field. So these are images running from about 3,000 to 8,000 angstroms. More or less, you can think of these as near ultraviolet, blue, green, and deep red. And you'll notice this clumpy thing in the middle is quite bright in these three filters, and it's completely gone in the near ultraviolet filter. This is a symptom of the Lyman-Brake. Submillimeter bright galaxies furnished additional technological challenges aside from identifying them, because for a long time the positions from submillimeter telescopes were imprecise enough. We had a hard time telling which thing in that error circle to point a big telescope at and get its spectrum. Recently, combining with other data has enabled us to find out where some of them are. Many of them are at redshifts of 2 to 3. Their dust emission indicates they have enormous rates of star formation. These may be the most important sites of star formation in the universe at that time. Some have buried quasars in their core. As we mentioned, we're starting now to see how these connect to the growth of galaxies.
These extremely red objects, as Phil mentioned, come in two classes. Some of these are high-redshift galaxies heavily reddened by star formation. The others are the ones I'm particularly interested in. These are galaxies that essentially formed all their stars very early in the universe, long before most of the other galaxies really got started. I'm going to go really quickly through this because we're running a little short on time. Basically, how do you recognize the two? They both, you see, have a really big jump between short wavelength and long wavelengths, but the kind that the star-forming ones that are obscured by dust follow the green curve here. They drop off rather gradually. The other kind, which is superimposed on a synthesized spectrum shifted to this red shift of old stars, shows this very sudden drop here. So that's how we tell the two apart. This shows a field that happens to have an example of each in it, a little washed out, but this is the star-forming type with the dust. It looks rather scruffy. The kind that has the old stars in it here looks much smoother. Here's the higher contrast versions of those pictures. And this is one at higher redshift in a radio galaxy field. This is an adaptive optics image of that, where you start to see the red object as a very smooth, regular thing. And this is when the universe is less than 3 billion years old. So it's only a quarter as old as it is now. Already this galaxy has settled down. And we go back to Bill here.
Okay, we'll try to throw out things rather than talk faster and faster. At high redshifts, we also find subgalactic objects. Objects which are forming stars very briskly, contain lots of hot young stars, but are much smaller than today's galaxies. To illustrate this, here we see a nearby bright spiral galaxy at the same ultraviolet wavelength. And here are some of these high redshift objects pasted in as if we were seeing them at the same distance. Each of these is individually brighter than this giant nearby spiral, but much smaller. And in some cases, these are double or multiple, suggesting that they'll fall together. So that this galaxy collision business was very important in the early universe. We also see that the early universe could be crowded. Here in one area, at one redshift, at a look-back time of about 10 billion years, we see a radio galaxy, a couple of quasars, several of these subgalactic lumps, and I'm not sure if you can see it or not because it's so red, but there's an extremely red object right here. Quasars turn out to be important in the early universe. They were the first objects we could find at high redshifts because they're so bright. And as far as we can tell, seeing a quasar means that an extremely massive black hole in the center of a galaxy is growing by accreting material. What we see is a byproduct of this accretion. Today, massive black holes are ubiquitous in bright galaxies. More or less, 0.5% of the stellar mass in the central bulges of spirals or the stars in elliptical galaxies is in a single massive black hole at the center. So this suggests that all these galaxies had to go through a quasar phase. We can now see them back to within a billion years of the epoch of creation. They were very common about 10 billion years ago, hundreds of times more common than they are in the local universe. Now, it seems to me one of the biggest questions in the early history of galaxies is posed by the fact that the spectra of quasars in the early universe look almost exactly like the ones that we see today. In particular, this gas surrounding the central object is enriched in heavy elements. You know, for once we actually mean metals, things like iron, nickel, magnesium, which as far as we can tell are produced only in explosions ending the lives of massive stars. Here's an average Hubble spectrum of quasars in the UV. Here's a hydrogen line. And the point is that these other features from nitrogen and oxygen and iron and magnesium are just as strong in these early quasars, which means they have to mark the sites where, for the very first time, clumps of stars were born, went through their life cycles, the massive ones exploded, and enriched the gas around them with what started off in their cores. So we're seeing some of the pieces that have to go into history of galaxies. Cosmic microwave background tells us that the universe started off almost perfectly smooth with tiny, part in 10 to the 5, ripples, which had to collapse under its excess gravity. It would be so nice to know what the dark matter is, because then we would know how it should behave, because it was calling all the shots at this point. Star formation begins. This is a feedback process, which blows away surrounding material. Production of heavy elements in stars, which then enriches further generation of star formation. This happens actively enough, as we saw in the M82 picture early on. You can have a galaxy-scale wind. While this is happening, gas is blowing out at the edges, it's accreting onto the central black hole in the center. All of this history of stars as we see it today couldn't begin directly. As far as we can tell, the most pristine gas left over before galaxies started was essentially pure hydrogen and helium. And the cooling processes that make gas clouds collapse to make stars today are extraordinarily inefficient until you have a small salting of heavier elements. There's now a consensus from calculations on what happens if you set out lumps of hydrogen and helium. The stars that you make will be much more massive than we see today, 80 to 300 solar masses, whereas the absolute upper limit for stars that we're sure of in the universe today is close to 100 solar masses. Because they were so big, so were massive, they were very hot, had short lifetimes, hundreds of thousands of years, and exploded as supernovae more energetic than today's stars do, throwing extraordinary amounts of heavy elements, especially oxygen, into the surrounding material. It disrupted their immediate clouds, but this was the price to pay for making possible the formation of today's generation of stars throughout the universe. And this didn't just enrich the surroundings, it slightly enriched the entire gas content of the universe. Here are some of Tom Abel's simulation of the process. You may have seen these in National Geographic or Discovery, where you start off with a million solar masses of gas, form one of these stars, it blows up, disrupts its surroundings completely. Looking for these explosions is one of the factors in planning new generations of tools. Several of the big questions in astronomy call for going farther into the infrared. So this has been a big push. I'll run through this sort of quickly. The successor to Hubble is now under construction, the James Webb Space Telescope, which will have a mirror almost three times the size and work much farther into the infrared in areas where the Earth's atmosphere is a very serious impediment. It's a worldwide effort to build a millimeter array telescope in Chile, known as ALMA. Now, the real punchline here is how all this sets the stage for human existence, how this connects to fine-tuning in the universe. Galaxies are important. They are the nurseries where materials collect for star formation through multiple generations enriching stars in heavy elements until you finally get something like the Sun, whose composition allows rocky planets. And this leads us to the anthropic principle, which essentially is the statement that if the universe had any property that prohibited thinking in soul beings, we wouldn't be here talking about it. It's a fancier, philosophically more respectable statement of the age-old awe and wonder, not just that we're here, but that anything is here. The reason it's an issue is that we now appreciate that there are many physical processes, constants of nature, physical laws, which couldn't tolerate a very large change before they prohibit anything remotely resembling our life. And this has led believers and non-believers among scientists and philosophers to ponder, how is it that we find ourselves in a universe which is so tightly tuned, so finely constructed to allow our existence? Consider the words of distinguished physicist Freeman Dyson.
Good day. As we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together for our benefit, it almost seems that the universe must in some sense have known that we were coming. Now, I'd like to introduce Sir Fred Hoyle. Now, Sir Fred, early on you found this strange fact about the carbon atom. The fact that there's any carbon in all the universe seemed very, very odd, and this is one of the few
cases where the anthropic principle actually led to an important scientific result. How did this affect you?
Would you not say to yourself, some supercalculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom? Otherwise, my chance of finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. Of course you would. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Or consider the conclusions of Paul Davies.
The really amazing thing is not that life on Earth is balanced on a knife edge, but that the entire universe is balanced on a knife edge and would be total chaos if any of the natural constants were off even slightly. You see, even if you dismiss man as a chance occurrence, the universe as a whole seems unreasonably suited to life. Almost contrived, you might say a put-up job. Now, this is not just a few people thinking this. This is a common consensus of people that would not be at this meeting, as Bill pointed out to me yesterday. There's universal agreement that there are only two real possibilities left to us. One is that the universe has been designed in such a way that this richness of structure that we see, including all the things we need for life, is latent in its very physical nature. The other, well, you might say the way out of this, for people that wouldn't be at this meeting, is that there's an essentially infinite number of universes, or an infinite number of distinct domains within this universe, so that all possible values of physical constants and physical laws are realized. And we just happen, of course, to be in the one that allows sentient life. Now, I just want to emphasize that these possibilities are not necessarily exclusive. That is, if we ever came up with a definite proof that this was the case, there still is there's still a lot of places where you still have to ask questions. As the cosmologist George Ellis in South Africa pointed out some time ago, all useful discussions, that is, discussions that don't really tell you anything of the very early universe, involve making metaphysical assumptions. And as he says, for the many domain universe, the question of why, if that is what is the case, why it has the properties it does is still a question. The essential issues remain. And then finally, we have sort of the ultimate question, why is there something rather than nothing? And that remains unanswered in all attempts at physical understanding. And of course, Stephen Hawking has put it quite bluntly, why does the universe go to all the bother of existing? Okay, can we negotiate two more minutes? Okay, how do the heavens declare the glory of God? Now, when you say declare something, if you're doing this in a court of law, you are stating categorically that there's no other alternative. But that declare can have other meanings. Now, if I declare my love for my wife, which she will tell you I don't do often enough, I'm not telling her something she doesn't know already. I'm affirming a bond that already exists. And to me, that's one of the meanings of this phrase, that the heavens declare the glory of God. We already have a relationship with the Creator. This reaffirms it. Do you have any other last minute comments on this?
No, as I want to do in a lot of talks I give, I think I'll let C.S. Lewis have the last word.
Okay. I'll just read this. You can probably read it yourself. The Christians and their opponents again and again expect that some new discovery will either turn matters of faith into matters of knowledge or else reduce them to patent absurdities. But it has never happened. What we believe always remains intellectually possible and never becomes intellectually compulsive. But with that, we affirm once again that the heavens declare the glory of God.
The interesting thing about the anthropic renewal is the fine tuning. So if it were broadly tuned, if we could have had a huge range of parameters, I think that would weaken the genetic case from this argument significantly. It's the knife edge aspect that makes it so interesting. So related to that, it seems to me that inflation is a bit of a challenge to the edge of view, because it would provide, some people would regard that as empirical evidence that indeed there is a multiverse. So that if everything that could happen did, then we are here by chance. And I'm wondering what your response is to that.
Well, to give too much of a response either way is almost an argument from ignorance, because we have no idea what might be the potential ranges of the physical parameters. And you're still sort of stuck with, okay, then why was the nature of matter and energy such that inflation occurred? Sort of, you're sort of stuck with the fabric of this multiverse. But this is one of the reasons why there's a major issue in how finely tuned do all these things have to be? And which ones are more deeply connected? You know, how many independent bits of tuning can you find? But one of the deeper issues is we don't know what the potential ranges of the cosmological mass density or the ratio of ordinary dark matter or the coupling constants of interactions might be. So we don't have much of a way other than intuition of saying how finely tuned is it, because with the one sample, we don't know what, you know, if you imagine rerunning the film, what the numbers of the ranges of possibilities are.
Do you want to try and answer that? We'll
I think in the interest of time, I won't try to give my answer.
What happens to quasars in their old age?
Quasars, our current understanding is that they're supermassive black holes on which material is falling. Now, they can quite rapidly eat up essentially all the material that's on potential orbits that bring it close enough to the black hole for it to fall in. And in a quiescent galaxy, we suspect over a period of a rather short period of a few hundred million years, that will happen. And then although the black hole remains in the center of the galaxy, there's nothing much to feed it. There was a very famous paper by James Gunn early on called Feeding the Monster, and it's really dealt with how do you manage to divert material in. That can happen when galaxies interact with each other. That can essentially re-trigger the activity. But we know that virtually all large galaxies today have supermassive black holes at their centers that are sitting there quietly, not doing much of anything. So that's basically how quasars die.
One more very quickly.
Yeah,
you can't remember all terms of the universe. Why should we expect that we all have to consider constants? Quite possibly we have a number of alternatives that I've been looking at. I have expressed now that you can't expect that.
That's a question that's fairly far outside my field of expertise, and I suspect Bill's. If you talk to, say, Andre Linde, he will give you reasons why you might expect the different realizations inflating regions within our own universe should have different physical constants. But this is really very, very speculative, and we don't really have any solid answer one way or the other on that. I think I just re-stress what George Ellis stresses, and that is that if we do live in a multiverse, which it's very hard to say whether we do or don't, and it's very hard to see how we will ever say whether we do or don't, but if we do, then that itself, we have to explain why that has the properties it has. In other words, there's an ambiguity in the word universe. Are we talking about our own little expansion region in that case? Universe really means all that exists in a physical sense. And we affirm as Christians that all is under God's control.
Okay.
social teaching. I remember having a very powerful one of the workers in the vineyard.
Uh-huh.
And doing the dignity of work.
Yeah.
The healing of the woman, I have a question on. She was healed.
Okay. So faith here does not mean intellectual assent. It does not mean acceptance of a certain body of teaching. It does not mean that she even knew Jesus necessarily personally. That's a very troubling piece of this story. Thank you for reminding me. I was kind of hurrying there. So it's about trust. The trust. Thank you for your attention. I gave you a very brief bibliography there. If anyone would like more expansive kinds of things, if you want some reading, I'll be happy to send you longer bibliography, particularly with some of these new kind of, like the social, historical stuff. Just send me a note and I'll be happy to do that. Thank you, and good luck with the rest of your conference.